Okay. We're on chapter 26 of the first book of Samuel. We've been making good progress. Feel free, to, by the way, to read over vacation. The Ziphites came to Saul at Gibeah and said, David's hiding in the hills of Hachilah facing Yeshimon. In other words, there were people, I mean, everybody's playing the odds here. There were people who were willing to inform on David to Saul, and some people who were willing to protect David from Saul. It's always a dangerous game. Netanyahu thought Romney would win. Saul went down at once. Some things never change. Sometimes you get it right, and sometimes you don't. Saul went down at once to the wilderness of Ziph, together with 3,000 picked men of Israel, to search for David in the wilderness of Ziph. And Saul encamped on the hill of Hachilah, which faces Yeshimon by the road. When David, who was then living in the wilderness, learned that Saul had come after him in the wilderness, David sent scouts and made sure that Saul had come. David went at once to the place where Saul had encamped, and David saw the spot where Saul and his army commander Abner, son of Ner, lay asleep. Saul lay asleep inside the barricade, and his troops were posted around him. Now, remember, the last time, what happened was Saul went to urinate, and David crept up behind him, cut off the corner of his cloak, later said to him, look, I could have killed you. Saul wept, said, I'm so sorry, I never should have done this, this is terrible, and now Saul's out with 3,000 men to kill him again. I suppose that you could interpret Saul's behavior as extremely cunning. That is, he was saying, I'm sorry to David in front of everyone to disarm David. But it seems more likely and feels more authentic that Saul is just emotionally inconsistent, bipolar. All sorts of diagnoses have been thrust upon Saul over the course of centuries. David spoke up and asked Ahimelech the Hittite and Abishai son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, who will go down with me into the camp of to Saul? And Abishai answered, I'll go down with you. So Abishai is obviously heroic here because he's taking a chance of being killed. So David and Abishai approached the troops by night and found Saul fast asleep inside the barricade, his spear stuck in the ground at his head, and Abner and the troops sleeping around him. And Abishai said to David, God has delivered your enemy into your hands today. Let me pin him to the ground with a single thrust of the spear. It's a little bit implausible. They're whispering, like Saul's right there. He doesn't just say kill him. He goes, let me pin him to the ground with a single thrust of the spear. So it could be that there's a little bit of poetic license here. I will not have to strike him twice. But David said to Abishai, don't do him violence. No one can lay hands on the Lord's anointed with impunity. Now, the other possibility, and I'm just saying, is that the author of this book, who we already think has some feeling of exonerating David, of making David look better than you might think reading between the lines, is inflating or concocting this scene here so that not only do others want to kill Saul, but David's own people want to kill Saul, and yet David is so moral and so upright and so good that even though Saul's right there and Saul has once again threatened his life, David will hear nothing of it. And now, just in case Saul didn't wake up from the whispering, David went on, as the Lord lives, the Lord himself will strike him down, or his time will come and he will die, or he will go to battle and perish, or to the Jewish home for the aged. But the Lord forbid, the Lord, right, exactly. Well, it was David's time, so the old one. But the Lord forbid that I should lay a hand on the Lord's anointed. Just take a spear and a water jar, just take the spear and the water jar at his head and let's be off. In other words, the exact same strategy as before, prove to him, take something that will prove to him that we were here, so that later we can say, I could have killed you, but I didn't, and and let's go away. So David took away the spear and the water jar at Saul's head, and they left. No one saw or knew or woke up. All remained asleep. A deep sleep from the Lord had fallen upon them. So first of all, I mean, it is improbable, not just that Saul didn't wake up. Okay, that you can understand. But none of his troops, none of these crack troops that defend the king woke up as these two people creep into the king's tent and take the water. And so the explanation has to be supernatural, obviously. They would have woken up, but God made sure that David would be protected. And just to be uncynical about it for a minute, the truth is that David's survival is remarkable. I mean, when the king is after you for clearly a long time, and you have a pretty powerful enemy in the course of mainly the Philistines, though not only, and you manage to die of old age in your bed, and when your own son rebels against you, after all, and you end up with, as you'll see, with lots and lots, with a trail of dead bodies after you, that David does survive could easily suggest to someone that God wanted him to survive, because there were lots and lots of times when things had gone just slightly the other way, David would be no more. David crossed over to the other side and stood afar on top of a hill. There was a considerable distance between them. And David shouted to the troops and to Avner, son of Ner, "Avner, aren't you going to answer?" And Avner shouted back, "Who are you to shout at the king?" And David answered Abner, "You're a man, aren't you? And there's no one like you in Israel. So why didn't you keep watch over the Lord your king? For one of our troops came to do violence to the Lord your king. You haven't given a good account of yourself. As the Lord lives, all of you deserve to die because you didn't keep watch over the Lord, over your Lord, the Lord's anointed. Look around. Where are the king's spear and water jar that were at his head?" Now, he doesn't at first tell Abner that he was the one who did this, maybe because he thought that would be too presumptuous and make him look bad, as opposed to one of his troops that went in and did it. Saul recognized David's voice, and he asked, "Is that your voice, my son David?" And David replied, "It is, my lord king." And he went on, "But why does my lord continue to pursue his servant? What have I done, and what wrong am I guilty of? Now let my lord the king hear his servant out. If the Lord has incited you against me, let him be appeased by an offering. But if it's men, let they be accursed of the Lord." In other words, if it's God who's telling you to get me, so we'll make an offering, and God will be satisfied that I've made penance for whatever it is I did. But if it's people that are telling you that you should kill me, then let them be cursed. For they've driven me out today so that I cannot have a share in the Lord's possession, but I'm told, go and worship other gods. Oh, let my blood not fall to the ground away from the presence of the Lord. For the king of Israel has come out to seek a single flea, as if he were hunting a partridge in the hills. And that's, by the way, I don't want to pass over it too quickly. It's kind of an interesting image that my blood will fall out, and that means it'll go away from God, because presumably God, your blood goes up to God, but down to the earth, which is away from God. And Saul answered, "I'm in the wrong. Come back, my son David, for I will never harm you again." Can't believe you guys don't. You're so cynical. "Seeing how you have held my life precious this day. Yes, I've been a fool, and I have erred so very much." And it's exactly, I mean, the Hebrew is ve'eshkeh harbe ma'od, which literally means I've made many mistakes, or I've made a huge a repeated mistake. David replied, "Here's your majesty's spear. Let one of the young men come over and get it." In other words, I'm not handing it to you. I'm not that stupid. remember, this is the spear that he threw at David more than once. In the privacy, the comforting privacy of his own home. "And the Lord will requite every man for his right conduct and loyalty. For this day," just not to put too fine a point on it, Saul, "the Lord delivered you into my hands, and I would not raise a hand against the Lord's anointed. And just as I valued your life highly this day, may the Lord value my life, and may he rescue me from all trouble." Saul answered David, "May you be blessed, my son David. You shall achieve, and you shall prevail." David went on his way, and Saul returned home. So, this is, what's that?
Did he give the sword back?
Apparently he gives the sword back. It doesn't say explicitly, but apparently he does. The spear, right. But the sense of this, again, is, I mean, why is the story here? Well, there are most... in some ways, ancient and modern scholars, although they phrase it differently, they have the same two fundamental reasons. One is the one that I already mentioned, which is it makes David look good, basically. It makes him look better than good. It makes him look noble, self-sacrificing, all of that. And the other is that it makes Saul and the people around Saul look bad. And even though we're used to the idea, I mean, we say, okay, Saul was king and then David was king, but it doesn't work that way. I mean, and here the political process, in a way, in America, is a good illustration. It's not like one person wins the presidency and then everybody who opposes him just goes away. And it doesn't work that way with kings either. The opposition hangs around, and they hang around with the intent, eventually, of usurping the guy who shouldn't have been there in the first place, which means that Saul's house, that is his family, his supporters, and so on, are still troubling David's house and will even until Solomon's time. And if you're writing a history to make them look less competent to persuade the persuadables, right? Not the people, not the diehards are not going to be persuaded, but others who might be, is the job of a historian slash propagandist. That's what you're supposed to do, is tell people it's not just that David is good and noble and self-sacrificing, but Saul and the people around Saul were really not up to the task. So those are the principal reasons probably why it's here and why the whole saga is here. And also, obviously, like as with everything in the story, it shows that God's providential design is in remarkable ways being carried out, even though normally you wouldn't think so. Yeah.
It seems that David also shows an enormous respect for the concept of being anointed.
Well, yes, that also, right, which also serves David's purposes, obviously.
Yes.
Obviously, right? One of the reasons why you show respect for a position you're about to enter is because you're about to enter it.
Yeah. Early on, you mentioned the author of this. Was that not Samuel?
Samuel? No. Whoever it wasn't Samuel, he's dead. The events that we're now reading took place after his death. So we don't know. The modern scholars assume that the author of the books of Samuel was a court historian from David's house long after David died, who brought together whatever documents there were and whatever stories there were and wove this tale. But the books of the Bible are not thought to be written by the people whose names are in the title. Like Job wasn't written by Job. So Samuel is just he's the featured beginning character, so he gets the book, but not the author. David said to himself, "Someday I shall certainly perish at the hands of Saul. The best thing for me is to flee to the land of the Philistines. Saul will then give up hunting me through the territory of Israel, and I will escape him." We've already seen this strategy. Remember, David feigns madness when he escapes. So David and 600 men went with him and crossed over to King Achish, son of Maoch of Gath. David and his men stayed with Achish in Gath, each man with his family, David with his two wives, Ahinoam the Jezreelite, and Abigail, wife of Nabal the Carmelite. Remember, Michal is for now out of the picture, Saul's daughter. It's been given to Palti. And when Saul was told that David had fled to Gath, he didn't pursue him anymore. He can't pursue David. This is a domestic dispute. You can't bring it to the Philistines, right? It's too risky. That's starting a war. So the same thing today. A fugitive runs to another country, and you don't invade that country in order to get a fugitive, even if the fugitive is somebody that you would very much like to get. David said to Achish, "If you please, let a place be granted me in one of the country towns where I can live. Why should your servant remain with you in the royal city?" At that time, Achish granted him Ziklag. That's how Ziklag came to belong to the kings of Judah, as is still the case. Those are the kinds of sentences that historians love, right? Because it tells you that a certain city belonged to the kings of Judah, which means that other cities didn't, and that the kings of Judah had some parts of Israel, but not other parts of Israel, and that they could trace it back to when David took it from the Philistines. And you start, if you know the map, you start to get a picture of where the different kingdoms started and ended. And remember that for most of the history of Israel before it was destroyed, it wasn't one kingdom, it was two kingdoms. There was Israel in the north and Judah in the south. So when you say that's how it came to belong to one of the kings of Judah, that means the kings of Judah in the south. And when you say that means that it was written after the split. That's why I say it was written a couple hundred years after David. Okay, let me just explain that again. David had a unified kingdom. Under Solomon, it was unified as well. After Solomon died, his kids and all subsequent kings of Israel, until well, for about 300 years, they split the kingdom into Israel in the north, Judah in the south, okay? That ended when the Assyrians came and destroyed the northern kingdom. That's when the 10 lost tribes got lost, because Judah is the dominant tribe in the south, 10 tribes are in the north, okay? That's when they ran here and there and everywhere. But for those 300 years after Solomon died, you've got Israel in the north, Judah in the south. So if someone during the time of David is saying, by the way, this city which David took belongs now to the kings of Judah and has ever since, that means that the book was written, or at least that sentence was written, after the kingdom split, which means that it was written at least 100, 150 years, maybe more, after the death of David. Okay, that's why historians love sentences like that, because it gives you a picture, a more, a fuller picture of when the books are written. Yeah. Okay, the north is destroyed in 722 BCE, before the Common Era. The south and the first temple is destroyed in 586, so about 150 years later. Jesus is born about 580 years after that.
In the south?
No, he's born actually in the north, in the Galilee, in Bethlehem and in the Galilee. But the south is destroyed in 586, and the country then belongs to the Babylonians, then to the Persians, in which some people from Israel come back, and then to the Romans, okay? And also as you know from Hanukkah, the Egyptians and the Seleucids trade the country back and forth. Because remember, Israel is here. All of Iraq, Babylonia, the Seleucid Empire, Syria, all of that's up here, and Egypt is over here. So for most of Israel's history, it was basically a ping pong ball between these two giant empires, Egypt and Iraq, Babylonia, Assyria, depending when. Then what happens is, about 150 years before the Common Era, that is before Jesus, what happens is the Jews are fighting among themselves. Actually happens, I think, around 80 BCE, close to 100 years before. The Jews are fighting among themselves. I know this will shock you. And they invite the Romans in to settle the dispute. And they never leave.
What was the reason of the dispute?
About who would rule, about the different ruling houses. And the Romans come in and settle the dispute in favor of the Romans. And then they don't leave. So the interesting thing is that from the time of David, almost, actually it may be literally from the time of David, with brief interludes, like during Hanukkah, with brief interludes, Israel was never, ever an independent country, ever, until 1948. It was always under one empire or another, right? It was under the British, it was under the Ottomans, it was under the Romans, it was under, always under someone else. And the reason, in part, that it's so hard to hold, I mean, if you go to Israel, you see this, is because it is this narrow strip of land with hills around it, and hills, you know, are great for invading. Like, you go to the Golan Heights, you could take over Israel from the Golan Heights if you had spitballs and stones, right? Because they're all down there and you're up here. And so it's not surprising that Israel's been repeatedly conquered, and it's a land bridge. And the great thing, I mean, the things about bridges is if you have a huge invading army and you just want to get from one place to another, so you conquer the bridge along the way. It's not a big deal. Yes?
So the Philistines at this time are not the enemy? I mean, that David would...
They are the enemy. That's why Saul won't go and get them.
I know that, but how can David go there?
Remember from last time that David already pretended to have a sympathy with the Philistines. Okay. So, and they know, they're playing a power game too. Okay. They know there's a struggle, so maybe they think if they give some shelter to the usurper that when and if he becomes king, he'll be more sympathetic to them. So David says to Achish, I gave him Ziklag, where are we? And the length of time, verse 7, that David lived in Philistine territory was a year and 4 months. So he lived there a long time, right? Which again, by the way, okay, so there are two ways of reading this. Cunning David fooling the Philistines into thinking he was sympathetic to them, or David was a traitor. And how do you think Saul and his people read this? a year and 4 months that you live in enemy territory and you don't ever do anything traitorous to convince them? I mean, isn't this the plot of like every mafia, is that someone from, you know, someone infiltrates the gang, but they have to shoot someone to prove their credentials. And then you wonder, do they shoot someone or don't they shoot someone? And if they shoot someone, are they really taken over by the mob or are they still? And this is David's situation here, because look at what it says next. And again, well, I'll read it and then you tell me what you think. David and his men went up and raided the Geshurites, the Gizrites, the Amalekites, who were inhabitants of the region of Elam, all the way to Shur and to the land of Egypt. Remember, even now there's a border between Egypt and Gaza, right? Same thing. There was then, I mean, even now. But I'm saying that's the same passage that exists now. That's what David used to raid in Egypt. When David attacked a region, he would leave no man or woman alive. He would take I'll come back to that. He would take flocks, herds, asses, camels, and clothing. When he returned and came to Achish, Achish would ask, "Where did you raid today?" And David would reply, "The Negev of Judah, or the Negev of the Yerachmeelites, or the Negev of the Kenites." David would leave no man or woman alive to be brought to Gath, for he thought they might tell about us. David did this. Such was his practice as long as he stayed in the territory of the Philistines. Achish trusted David. He thought, "He's aroused the wrath of his own people Israel, and so he will be my vassal forever." Okay, so now what's going on here? Two different possible readings. One is, David is telling, and this is what the Bible explicitly claims. David is telling Achish, the king of the Philistines, "I'm raiding the Israelites and getting stuff from them." Okay? But what he's really doing is he's raiding other people and killing them all so that nobody can come back and say, "It was really us that David raided," right? So Achish believes him because David and his band are raiding these people who Achish, who are under Achish's rule, but Achish doesn't know about it, okay? And he's going far away, like Egypt, and because he doesn't want word to ever get back. The other possibility is that, in fact, and there are some hints about this later in the book, although really just hints and we don't know, is that David is raiding in Israel, which is why Achish trusts him. But the writer doesn't want to say that, so he protects David. And David's raiding in Israel wouldn't be that implausible because, remember, we already saw him do it with Naval, where he says to Naval, "I protected these people, now give me money." Naval says no, and he goes to kill him. So it's not as though this way of life is completely unfamiliar to David, and it's not impossible. That doesn't mean he's killing everybody, by the way. It could literally just mean he went into Israel territory, he raided, he got stuff, he brought it back, and Achish was pleased, and because it looked like Israelite stuff, he trusted him. So it could go either way, or it could be a combination of the two, but it's an explanation for how it is that David manages to survive this period in Philistine territory, because otherwise, obviously, he wouldn't be able to survive. Okay, end of chapter, time for questions. Yes?
Why isn't David living with Abigail?
Because it's not safe. Presumably, if he lives anywhere that Saul has influence and Saul knows where he is, he'll come to kill him. So he can't live anywhere in Israel because that's the first place Saul's going to look. Yeah. I'm sure he's taking a large percentage. Right. That's why David brings it back to him. It says, right, when David attacked, when he returned and came to Achish, Achish would ask, "Where did you raid today?" That's why he's asking. I mean, this is how David is managing to stay there for as long as he is. Yeah. Levites, Kohanes, they don't have territory. We're just talking about tribes that have territory.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, some yes, some no. Some are guesses. Some we know we're pretty sure. It varies. Yeah.
So at this time, David has been anointed king?
Yes, apparently.
Saul knows this? Saul doesn't believe in the sanctity of the Lord.
Well, he's been anointed too.
I know. But
so, Why should he, you know, why should he give that to David? And he wasn't there when David was anointed. And I guess Saul has probably heard the claim that David was anointed. That doesn't mean he has to believe it or acknowledge it, even if he does believe it. And also my guess is that Saul's, I mean, I have no idea what Saul's thinking, but if Saul's thinking about it, he probably assumes that if God didn't want him on the kingship, he wouldn't be there, and he can always reclaim God's favor. Maybe he lost God's favor, but he can reclaim God's favor. So, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
The results that you see and kind of can help you explain.
So theologically, how do you explain this? It depends where you are on the theological spectrum. So a traditional explanation would be that in fact God favors David. Saul has disobeyed God's law. And because Saul is being wicked now, David is not yet king, but David is showing how God is protecting him, even in the land of the Philistines, because he wants to make him king forever and ever. And there's no contradiction. God makes human beings with good inclinations and evil inclinations, and always did, and people do bad things along the way. Even good people do bad things, although the rabbis tried very hard to exonerate David at every moment, right? That's the traditional explanation. The other explanation is it depends how closely you believe that God intervenes in history as opposed to wanting large patterns to emerge. So maybe what God wants is for David eventually to be king and for Israel to be a state that shows fidelity to God, but how that comes about might not be micromanaged. So you use flawed human beings for good ends. And you can ask the same question, after all, at any moment in history of any group, certainly of any group in Israel throughout all of our history. People are always fighting. I mean, we sanitize history, but Jewish history is as filled with fractures and infighting and so on as any other history. So, and the other one is that this is a book that recounts a power struggle in ancient times with which God has very little, other than the fact that the people involved think God has a lot to do with it. So. I mean, you can take any one of those three explanations, and all of them are advanced, but it entirely depends what your theological take on this is. Yeah. I don't remember, but I'll take your word for it. I'll take your word for it. People say all sorts of things.
Blasphemy and all.
Right.
Is there much objective evidence supporting the actual David story?
None.
None,
and by the way, we don't have the stones from Solomon's temple either. That's also in dispute in some ways. The only thing we have is we have an inscription from a couple hundred years later that says Beit David, the house of David. But all of these individuals, Yoav, Avner, Saul, they're all lost in the mists of time until the next discovery. What you can do is you can compare what we know about the story to other stories in the area at the time, the way it's written to the way other things were written, the plausibility of the situation to what we know about the history of the age, those kinds of things you can do, and also the complexity of the narrative, how complicated it is, and the fact that it doesn't, that it's not just, oh, David was perfect in every way, argues for a high degree of realism. I mean, why would you make up this story that makes Saul look bad and could easily make David look bad if you just shift the lens a little bit, unless the people around you know the story, so you can't change it that much. So it reads plausibly, and there's slight evidence that David existed, but more than that we don't have. This makes, by the way, writing a book about David easier in some ways, because what you're really writing about is the narrative. You're not writing about the history. There is some history to be brought to bear. And those of you, if you're interested in, if you want the most scholarly treatment that is still readable, but it takes some work, of the David narrative, it's written by a man named Baruch Halpern. He's a historian, and he goes through the narrative really carefully with all the possible parallels. And you can skip also the parts that are more technical. There's also another one written by a guy named Mackenzie that's a little more readable, that also that sees David really not very flatteringly. But both of them, I mean, most scholars seem to think that there's a lot of history in here, but there's no, we haven't found any like stones that say, you know, David slept here. Yeah.
All this trouble is we have this story by whoever wrote it. Didn't anybody else write a story about the same events?
Who knows? The answer is no, we don't have one. We only have this one.
So we only have this
one. We only have this one.
Whoever he is, this
right.
Guy's word for
that. We only have that. But remember that if a story is popular and takes, I mean, preserving anything from the ancient world is very hit or miss. So unless something is pretty widespread and popular and is the version that is accepted, it's not going to survive anyway. Someone else could easily have written a version, but why would, we even have mention, I don't know if you're aware of this, there's mention of books in the Torah that we no longer have. It says you can look this up in the book of Yashar or in the book of the kings of Israel, and we don't have those books. So we know that there were other writings in ancient times that we don't have. Presumably they were. Presumably he took documents together. He didn't write this, you know, from scratch. Every modern scholar believes that the Torah itself has multiple sources. There is no modern scholarship that assumes it's all from one source.
Have you decided how you would portray David?
Yes.
And read the book to find out.
Yeah, exactly. No. Buy the book to find out. Reading is optional. Purchasing is one for Kindle and one, you know, to have on your shelf. I have my own ideas, but I have no idea. E.M. Forster, the writer of some wonderful novels, like A Room with a View, and the most famous one is the one India. Oh, what's it called? Passage to India. Thank you. He said, "How do I know what I think till I see what I say?" And the truth is, you can plan a book, but when you start to write it, it doesn't necessarily come out the way that you assume beforehand. So even though I have ideas of what I'm going to say, I have no idea if that's how it's going to come out. Yeah. Yes.
So, I mean, what have we learned from this? Is God favoring? It's very difficult to suggest this because Saul is not favored by God anymore because he refused to kill one person. And
so,
David killing everybody, and
this is the two sides of the religious argument. The dangerous side and the side that people who favor religion urge. The dangerous side is, okay, if God loves me, I can do what I want, because anything I do, therefore, is presumptively an expression of God's love. So I can fight in battle and kill people because that's what God wants, because I'm God's chosen. And that's a very dangerous, yes, it is a dangerous assumption, and it certainly does seem that that's what David's doing here, and it doesn't seem that the biblical author is troubled by it at all. It's like, yeah, David went and he killed all these people and he brought back the booty and Achish trusted him. And the idea here clearly is the ends justify the means. We're just trying to keep David alive. So yeah, that should trouble anyone. But all I can say is you can't read any part of the Bible without that question coming up. It comes up again and again and again and again, right? You go into Canaan and God says, kill men, women, and children. So and the other side of it is that presumably if you are religious, it prescribes certain values in advance that don't allow you to do X, Y, or Z. But it's very, even today, it's very hard for people to hold on to the idea that enemies shouldn't be obliterated. I can't tell you how often I have heard people who are otherwise humane, otherwise thoughtful, and otherwise decent, and I use the otherwise deliberately, say we should just go into Gaza and just bomb everything flat. Which is no different than saying go into Canaan and kill men, women, and children. Same thing. It's like, okay, so there are kids there. Too bad they're Arab kids, right? They're going to grow up to be enemies. And you hear that, and it's for the same reason. It's not because those people, as I say, are otherwise not humane. It's because there's a primitive desire to not just win over your enemy, but to make sure that they'll never fight again, to really, and it's true in the ancient world too. So you find it all over the Bible. You find it all over the ancient world and in the modern, yeah. Right. You shouldn't make peace with what you read. I don't want any student to make peace with this. Meaning they should think that this is not a good thing. I don't want to explain David's actions in a way and they go, okay, oh, then it's all right. That's a bad thing. They should be ill at ease with this, of course. I want them to feel like the Bible critiques the Bible. That when you get upset at things in the Torah, it's because of values you have learned from the Torah.
But isn't this exactly that the Torah is teaching us?
I hope not. If the Torah is teaching, yeah, it's okay to kill men, women, and children, because after all, David has to be king, I think that's not a lesson that we want to, I mean, do you? Of what?
Bill Maher.
Yeah.
Bill Maher.
Yeah.
You know, when he talked about just go and read the Old Testament.
Right.
It's so difficult to convince. I'm not fighting. I'm just trying to see what I can tell you about people. When they read the part of it, because it's not possible to read all of it.
Right.
And they come with a question that Saul, remember Saul said that go and kill even the sheep?
Yes. The way I just said to you. I said, you're absolutely right. I'm really glad to know that that troubles you. It should trouble you. I wouldn't suggest that it shouldn't. And it troubles you, by the way, because you believe in the principles that the Torah teaches. So when characters in the Torah are seen to violate those principles, you're troubled by it, as you should be. But the point is, if the Torah didn't teach those principles, you wouldn't be troubled by it. If the Torah really taught it's good to kill men, women, and children all the time, you would say, oh, well, that's what the Torah obviously teaches. But obviously, when you read the Torah as a whole, the lesson of it is the sanctity of human life and that human beings are created in the image of God. And you see that people, even religious people, can't always hold to that. You see that in the world today. But the fact that it troubles you makes me know that you've grasped the essential teaching of the Torah and you're even able to judge the story of the Torah by what matters most. But I don't want to explain, I don't want to say to somebody who says there are brutal things in the Torah, no, they're not. I mean, who would say such a thing? I don't think that the way to defend the Torah is to be dishonest about it. Yeah.
So all throughout our life, David has been glorified.
Yep.
David never
fell.
Exactly. He has been the king.
I know.
So now we feel that.
So then the question is why? The question is why, and that's actually that's the question ultimately that I actually am writing the book to answer. I mean, I have my own answer, but why is it that David is chosen when he's clearly so problematic and complicated a character? Why do we pick David? Why can't we pick, you know, somebody who at least their story is less complicated, like Avraham? Although Avraham did, right? He did.
He has a lot of blood on his hands.
He does. And in fact, so much blood on his hands that God won't let him build the temple. Remember, it says explicitly that God won't let me build the temple because I've been in so many wars. And Solomon gets to build the temple because although he has 1,000 wives, he doesn't kill a lot of people. You know? Hey, listen, make love, not war. Yes. No. Of Torah. No, there isn't at all. Yeah. There's the Ark, and the Ark contains the covenant, but more than that, no. I can't hear you. Well, he repents specific actions. He's very sorry that he drove Avshalom to rebellion. He repents Bathsheba, but he doesn't repent for the raids that he does. And by the way, his last words are to Solomon to tell him to kill all the enemies that David didn't get to kill when he was alive. I'm telling you, I'm not kidding. It's like, you know, it's as if on my deathbed I were to say to my daughter, listen, this member gave me such a hard time. Don't forget to make sure to deprive them of high holiday seats. You'll know what to do. I mean, it's wild. It's just wild. But that's what David does. He literally, his last words are to Solomon to say, Shivi ben Bichri, don't let his gray hairs go down in peace to Sheol. So now here is a question, though, that is worth considering. And I don't know how you come out on this. And this is, I mean, if I were having a longer conversation with that, with whatever young person would come to me and say, you know, the Torah is full of, I would say, first of all, as has been said, Balzac said this, actually, the French writer, he said, every great fortune is founded on a great crime. Now, that is not only true of great fortunes, it's certainly true of countries. Every country is founded on a crime, right? Fortunate is the country whose crime is so shrouded in the mists of prehistory that nobody remembers it. Nobody remembers what the original battles were and the original slaughters. In America, we have a lot of blood on our hands. A lot of blood. I remember when my brother my oldest brother was an undergraduate in Amherst, and he discovered that Jeffrey Amherst in part made his reputation by distributing tubercule blankets to the Indians. And he felt a little bit less good about going to Amherst University. But obviously, that's because nobody founds a country of people by acclamation, right? Nobody just comes into a country and says, you know what, let's have Italy here. And everybody goes, okay. I mean, you look at Rome and so on. They're always it's in war, always it's in bloodshed. So the question really is for the person to answer. If it was necessary to have a figure like David, as it clearly is, to establish ancient Israel, and there could not be, bless you, an ancient Israel without this kind of battle, and all of history demonstrates that, then is it worth it to have an Israel for a David to have arisen? Because sooner or later, some figure would have arisen.